You are listening to No More Normal. We call it Nomono. I am Khalil Colonna. When President Trump and ICE got into the act of separating families and locking kids in cages, it spurred a public outcry. Millions of people were appalled that the land of the free would treat people in such a manner, especially people who were counting on the United States to provide safety, as they were often fleeing life-threatening situations. As usual in this country, the news cycle changed and a majority of the public stopped talking about it. Then the COVID-19 came, and the call to release detainees has picked up again, a call to save lives, a call to treat people like humans. As the pandemic continues to dominate our lives, the threat of COVID-19 spreading in detention centers became a reality. What's not real? The response from ICE and the federal government.
Even when Congress finds out about what's going on and has hearings, ICE doesn't report accurately on what it's doing, doesn't hold accountable the agents who are clearly harming people and putting people in danger.
That was Jackie Stevens. We will hear more from her later on in the show. Today, we just don't look at the dire situation for the people, but ask what, if anything, can be done about it. To get a sense of what it's like being detained by ICE during the pandemic, reporter Yasmin Khan talked on the phone with a man who's been there for more than a year.
The Cibolo County Correctional Center is run by the corporation Core Civic in Milan, New Mexico. Juan Carlos Peña from Cuba has been in ICE detention there since he arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border on March 29th last year. He's one of eight ICE detainees who are housed together there right now. Behind Cibolo's walls, there are also prisoners in the custody of the U.S. Marshals Service and inmates of Cibolo County. Minutes before our interview, Peña learned that his latest appeal for release was denied.
Tengo 51 años, voy a cumplir 52 ahora en noviembre. Tengo condiciones médicas, soy asmático, tengo 1,000 documentos. Los abogados de ahí se han fajado y le han mandado 1,000 documentos.
I am 51 years old. I have asthma. I have tons of documents. The lawyers have sent tons of documents, so they will release me under supervision. But I was denied release again today. I feel crazy. I will do a hunger strike. Either they take me out of here dead, or they let me go.
There are 314 cases of coronavirus inside Cibolo, according to Friday's numbers from the state's Department of Health. And although people detained by ICE are separated from everyone else, Peña says one young man who's been there for 3 years still contracted the virus.
Sí, tengo, yo tengo mascarilla, sí, tengo, gracias a Dios tengo una mascarilla y esas cosas, pero aquí a nosotros hicieron hace unos meses atrás.
I have masks, thank God. A few months ago, they gave us coronavirus tests, and one person was positive. The young man was from Sri Lanka, and after he went through quarantine, he was put back with us, but we were never tested again.
Peña is afraid to catch the virus, he says, and he's frustrated that ICE officials don't take his doctor's warning seriously.
Pero claro, si a mí me coge el coronavirus, imagínate tú, a mí me coge el coronavirus, me inducen el coma.
Of course, if I get coronavirus, it will put me in a coma. I would have to go on a respirator and I would die. Sometimes I can't breathe. Sometimes I have panic attacks. The arguments ICE has is they say that I don't have a medical condition. They are just overlooking all the documents I have that say I have a medical condition, that I am asthmatic. It is full of coronavirus here. If I get it, I will die. They just overlook all the documents and say, no, I can't leave.
Peña says he wants to be released under supervision to his family in Miami. That detention without any answers or decisions is putting him and other immigrants in both physical danger of coronavirus and is causing mental health issues, especially for the youngest people who are about 20 years old and those who don't have legal representation. As the eldest detainee at 51, Peña says he sees the younger men like his sons.
Y me duele, me parte el alma verlos en esta situación, gente que no son, muchachos que no son criminales, muchachos buenos, de buena familia, ¿ves?
It hurts. It hurts my soul to see these young men here, boys, who are not criminals, good boys who come from good families, people who have no criminal record in their country or here.
He knows there are people in New Mexico fighting for the rights of detainees and prisoners, Peña says, and he is grateful to have legal representation. But the whole world needs to know what is happening in ICE detention.
Porque es inhumano.
It's inhumane. There are people who pick up dogs in the street, they give them a blanket and food. But why do we, human beings, people who have not committed any crime, they have us locked up for nothing? One man has been here for 3 years.
The lack of forward movement on his case, fear of contracting coronavirus while in detention, and worrying about family members' health during the pandemic has taken a serious mental toll, says Pena. He says he will begin a hunger strike if he is not released soon. For No More Normal, I'm Yasmin Khan.
Many thanks to Benjamin Eaglin for reading the translations and to Yasmin Khan for that reporting. I have on the line now Arifa Raza, an attorney with the New Mexico Immigrant Law Center. How has the pandemic affected the weight and the uncertainty that people are going through?
What we've seen specifically in New Mexico is the removals of people have come to a standstill because of the pandemic. So people that, you know, either signed their deportation or were ordered removed, they're just stuck waiting in detention. And ICE has the authority or the discretion to let them out and wait for their deportation outside of detention. But we're not seeing that. We are really pushing ICE to release people so that they could wait with their families outside where they can socially distance and protect themselves, but they're not removing anyone, they're not releasing anyone. People are just stuck.
Because of the urgent physical health concerns, are we thinking enough about the mental health concerns of people?
Definitely not. The men that we've been working with, we've had them all evaluated by mental health professionals so that we can show ICE that given this prolonged detention and the pandemic, they are suffering a lot of like emotional and psychological issues. And ICE is, I don't think they're even looking at these evaluations that we're providing them.
Wow. What are you hearing from your clients about conditions in ICE detention centers during the pandemic?
There isn't any social distancing, obviously, when you're being held with groups of men. What we're also hearing is that people keep getting transferred from different facilities. And so when you're transferring folks all around the country, you don't know who has symptoms, who doesn't have symptoms, who may be sick. So it doesn't look like ICE is really taking the precautions that they said they would, just based on what we're seeing and what we're hearing.
Is it more difficult at this time to get a hearing date or a trial date?
Yes. Well, just a couple days ago, the El Paso court and Otero, which is the detained court, has closed, which means that anyone that had court dates in those courts are now just stuck waiting on a new hearing date. And we don't know when they'll reopen and when they'll reschedule. So people that have been, you know, waiting on their court dates, now they're going to have to wait longer in detention.
Longer in detention, increased health risks, increased mental health risks.
Exactly.
What are you thinking about when you started to hear about the coronavirus spread in detention? What was on your mind?
This was a big fear of ours. I think anyone that does any detention work knows there's a long history of medical negligence in detention centers. So a lot of us, you know, we're really concerned for people in these detention centers because there's no reason for them to be held. And now with this pandemic, we're scared that a lot of people are going to get sick. And those that are getting sick may not be able to access the medical care that they need. We're not allowed to go into the detention centers. So all our work is over the phone, which also makes things a little bit more difficult because we can't really see for ourselves. They're on the phone, so they may not be as comfortable sharing things as they used to be with us when they were able to talk to us face to face.
Have you encountered troubles talking with your clients?
There has been a couple times because of lockdowns at the facility or days that they decided to implement whatever medical testing that they were going to do, so then they cancel all calls with attorneys. So we have seen a lot of like rescheduling and some access to legal calls.
Are you concerned about transparency with what's happening in ICE detention at the moment?
Yes. It seems as though ICE has used this opportunity as an excuse to just create a black hole. I can send as many emails and as many phone calls as I want, but nobody responds. And whereas before, you know, worst case scenario, you could go down to the ICE office and try to talk to somebody, now the ICE office is closed. Mm. So there is really no way to get people's attention at ICE. There is no transparency at this point.
So given this lack of transparency, do you think that ICE is correctly reporting the coronavirus numbers inside their centers?
No. And one of the reasons is we're hearing reports from our clients that they're not getting tested. So as we know, if you don't get tested, it's very hard to determine who has COVID-19 and who doesn't. So we don't really believe the numbers that ICE is reporting.
Is there anything that can be done about this situation? Is there anything any of our listeners can do?
I think it would be great if listeners could call their congressional delegates, even call the ICE office and just leave messages that people that shouldn't be detained should be released, especially those people that have vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. So we've seen men that have asthma, that have heart conditions, that are a little bit older, who were requesting their release since they have no criminal record, they have no reason to be detained, yet they're being denied release. So at minimum, the people that are most vulnerable to COVID-19 should be released.
She is Arifa Raza, attorney with the New Mexico Immigrant Law Center. Arifa, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
We reached out to ICE for an interview, but the agency declined. Spokesperson Leticia Zamaripa sent over this written statement. Since the start of the pandemic, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has taken significant measures to mitigate the spread of COVID-19, including screening for symptoms and increased testing for many of those scheduled for removal. The health, welfare, and safety of ICE detainees is one of the agency's highest priorities. Since the onset of COVID-19, ICE has regularly updated infection prevention and control protocols to help prevent potential exposure among detainees. We'll include more of what ICE sent over on the post on this show online at KUNM.org. Dr. Josiah Rich is an expert on detention health who consults for the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. He's not speaking for DHS during this interview. Dr. Rich is represented as a whistleblower by the Government Accountability Project. Dr. Rich, thanks so much for being with me.
Thank you, Khalil.
So at the start of the pandemic, you raised an alarm before Congress about the serious public health risks inside ICE detention facilities. Why did you bring this to their attention?
I have been working in correctional facilities, predominantly in Rhode Island State, for the past 25 years, mostly providing clinical care and infectious disease care. So I'm quite familiar with how prisons are run and how they're set up and how healthcare works there. And as soon as we heard that this coronavirus was highly transmittable between people, so it was quite obvious relatively early on that this is going to be a huge problem. So what has worked to stop the spread is what we call social distancing, which is really physical distancing, and using masks. And you can use masks, but you can't physically distance. There isn't 6 feet of space between people in these facilities, and many facilities are at or above capacity. And you'd think that if people are confined in a facility, locked in jail cells, that they would be safe. Well, many are not single cells. Many have the same air they're breathing is the same as the person in the next cell, even if they are single cells. But a lot of them are in massive congregate spaces where there's, you know, only a few toilets that are shared, a few showers that are shared, and everybody eats together. And it's just a recipe for disaster.
Now, you provide care for coronavirus patients. Are these folks in detention or are they elsewhere?
My usual day job is I work at the Miriam Hospital, a Brown University teaching hospital, as an academic physician. And when the pandemic hit Rhode Island and our cases soared, I spent a lot of time in the hot zone every day. So as soon as that happened, our medical director wisely shut down all visits, including and especially my visits to the state correctional facility. She didn't want me bringing in the virus into the Rhode Island Department of Corrections. She's done a remarkable job of holding the line. We had a call in, again, late February, a meeting saying, okay, what is going on here? What do we do? You know, how many N95 face masks do we have today in the facility? You know, a lot of times when you have a public health crisis, the authorities that are in charge of public health are not cognizant or aware of detention facilities. They're kind of out of sight, out of mind. The first step is to make a good connection between the people running correctional institutions and the public health. Like if you have a statewide plan, the correctional authorities should be there at the table. The public health authorities don't understand the realities of what's going on in corrections. But the virus is primarily transmitted by person to person. So you'd think that, oh, well, you lock up the prison and you're all set, right?
Yeah.
As long as it's not in there, you're good. Well, the problem is people come and go in all the time. And people newly arrested or detained or sentenced go in. And that, fortunately, slowed down dramatically across the country. But you have people that work there. For the most part, it's not been detained people that have been responsible for bringing the virus in.
Mm-hmm.
It's been the staff and correctional authorities. And one of the things that particularly in ICE detention facilities they like to do is transfer people around.
And final, you're someone who's on the inside and you see this pandemic and how it's affecting our public health. What should we as the public really be thinking about, not only for the matter at hand and what we're immediately in facing and trying to battle this pandemic, but when it comes to the future and understanding public health and safety and how to tackle this issue that's meant for us all, but only seems to be given to a few?
We have this notion that in our country that there are rules, and if you break the rules, there are consequences. You know, if you do the crime, you do the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the thinking goes, and it just stops there. But we're also in this awakening moment where, you know, we're understanding that people who are black and brown are treated very differently in our society. And most people that aren't black and brown have not realized that.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's this term structural racism, and everybody's kind of trying to get wrap their head around it. What does that mean? Well, you need look no further than our criminal justice system. That is the very definition of structural racism. People who are black and brown are no different than anyone else, except they're incarcerated at much higher rates. We have an opportunity right now to rethink what are we using this tool of incarceration for and why, and to what end, and are we achieving that end? This is extremely expensive to lock people up in congregate settings. And with this pandemic, it's just become a lot more expensive.
Yeah. I want to thank you again for taking time to speak with me. He is Dr. Jody Rich, an expert on detentional health who consults with the Department of Homeland Security. Dr. Rich is represented as a whistleblower by the Government Accountability Project. Dr. Rich, thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Khalil.
After our conversation, Dr. Rich hit me up to state that, quote, a major reason that our incarceration rate is so much higher than all of the other countries is the war on drugs. We lock up people for using drugs, and guess what? That doesn't work. End quote. Thanks, Dr. Rich. We reached out to all of the state's federal representatives and senators to talk about ICE detention. Senator Tom Udall and Representative Deb Haaland cleared a few minutes to answer our questions. An investigation by the New York Times and the Marshall Project that showed that the U.S. was deporting people with coronavirus to other countries. That means the United States is spreading it around the world. Is there anything that can be done to stop this practice?
It's appalling what they're doing. I think what we should be doing is organizing, asking questions, making sure that this agency is accountable, keeping up the pressure on them. I think you'll probably see the House holding the hearings. We can't ever get our Republican chairman over here to do hearings and bring these people in to be accountable. But I'm extremely concerned about COVID-19 outbreaks in ICE facilities and the potential for spread to surrounding communities. You know, you have people going in as guards and other kinds of employees and coming out every day. So you're not only infecting other countries with the deportation, you're infecting the communities, and that can spread.
Do you feel, from what you've heard about the conditions going on in ICE facilities, do you feel like these are human rights violations?
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, look, I feel healthcare is a human right. It truly is. And when you're putting people in these crowded conditions and you don't know who has COVID-19 and who doesn't, and you're not taking any precautions with respect to that, you are jeopardizing people's lives. those are human rights violations.
Oh, I think there are serious human rights problems within these facilities. If you don't follow public health measures and you have other human beings that are in these facilities and you're not treating them with basic public health measures, they don't have enough PPE. Many of them, we hear the guards not wearing masks. I mean, that's basic public health that ought to be obeyed and followed in an institution like this.
Why can't anyone intervene?
As Congress, yes, we have the duty of oversight, and we've worked very hard to do that. We've sent letters, we've demanded answers, we have hauled people in for hearings.
Congress has the power of the purse. Is there the potential of less funding?
Well, the power of the purse is, as you say, is Congress. See, that's split between the House and the Senate. We need to agree. I would like to see us put the language in which would require them to deal with deportation situation. They shouldn't be deporting people who have COVID-19. That's irresponsible. They shouldn't be spreading the virus to other countries.
Unfortunately, we have a president who absolutely doesn't care. He made it clear even before he was elected that his clear disdain for immigrants in our country, the clear way to make sure that things change is to make sure that this president doesn't get reelected. I mean, that is the fact.
The president expanded ICE detention until it became the largest system in the world, according to the ACLU. Trump is saying that he may not step down. He's defunding the Postal Service to make it harder for people to vote by mail. We're having conversations about our democracy that many of us might not have imagined a couple years ago. What, if anything, can slow this train? And I ask that because we've had several people from other countries who've experienced authoritarian control from what was once a democracy, and we're seeing almost a literal playbook.
Well, there's no question that this president is a complete threat to democracy in our country. What we absolutely need is a large public outcry. There were protests in Michigan. There need to be protests all over the country with respect to how they are handling the U.S. Postal Service. It's ridiculous, it's dangerous, it's undemocratic, and it's a slap in the face to every single veteran postal worker and letter carrier who have dedicated decades to ensuring that our elderly folks get their medicines on time, that people get their graduation announcements. They have pride in delivering the mail.
We're 81 days from an election, and if people feel strongly about this, they ought to get out and vote. We're going to do everything we can to make these elections safe. Some of this is going to be done by mail. Even Republican states like Ohio have changed the system. We are having meetings here at the local level with our postmasters and trying to find out exactly what the impact will be on the election. We feel pretty good about the situation in New Mexico, but we're going to continue to monitor over these next 81 days to make sure nothing happens that could hurt people's right to vote.
You know, it's not just Democrats who are going to vote by mail. It's elderly Republicans who deserve to have their voices heard as well. You know, my mother relies on the mail for medication that she gets. This is something that is jeopardizing the health and safety of our country, and we're going to do all we can to make sure that we stop it.
My next guest is Professor Kenzie Cornejo, who teaches contemporary art in Latin America at the University of New Mexico. She's here to provide some context and history about U.S. actions that spurred migration from South America. Dr. Cornejo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
In recent years, people from Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua have made their way to the U.S.-Mexico border, and this was used as a fear tactic in campaigns in 2018. It seems like in the news, little consideration is given to how the United States helped create situations where so many people need to leave their home countries. Can you tell us a little bit more of the recent history on that?
U.S. involvement in Central America has a very long history. I mean, we can go way back to U.S. corporations, land theft, the Panama Canal, exploitation of workers, preserving U.S. interests. But more recently, what explains this current situation is a few decades ago in the 1980s and 90s, the U.S. was very heavily involved in fueling and funding civil wars throughout Central America. Mm-hmm. So it funded a civil war in El Salvador from 1980 to 1990. 1992 and one in Guatemala from 1960 to 1996. And at the same time, it funded counter-revolutionary groups known as Contras in Honduras and Nicaragua that were designed to combat so-called communism throughout the region. So even though we only have official wars, let's say in El Salvador and Guatemala, the violence in the presence and occupation of the U.S. was felt throughout the entire region. And this was done through billions of dollars a day in military funding, in training soldiers in Central America at the School of the Americas on torture techniques, on interrogation techniques, on how to use U.S. military weapons. So this was literally a war, decades of war fueled by the U.S. government. And this is what caused the first wave of mass migration from Central America, especially from the same countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, which are known as the Northern Triangle of Central America. So that first wave of migration happened in the 1980s and 90s. What people kind of forget to look at is the aftermath of those decades of civil war in the region. What happens when all of a sudden the wars supposedly end, but then you're left with a region that is financially distraught, where all of these injustices have been committed? And the thing that we have to look at about this U.S. funding of wars in the region is that it was incredibly violent, and it had a very unique aesthetics of violence. And what I mean by that is that what is known about this time is that through this U.S. military training of Central American governments, some of the practices that were used to instill fear in the Central American people were, for instance, visibly leaving dismembered bodies in public spaces or decapitated bodies. It was an extreme aesthetics of war that was visually very present for the Central American people. So now you have the aftermath of that, where all of these countries are left with unresolved injustices, traumas, displacement, family separation as a result of the mass migration during the war. And then this aftermath produces new manifestations of violence in the region. For instance, the emergence of transnational gangs, or the high rise of gender violence, or the criminalization of the poor, and as a result, high levels of mass incarceration. So what we see now, this wave of Central American migration from these countries, usually one of the things that they say at the border is that the reason that they're fleeing for their lives is, for instance, gang terror, right? They have been threatened, or they have been raped in some cases, or their families have been threatened or disappeared or murdered. And what we need to understand is that that gang violence is actually a U.S. product. It was made by the U.S. back in the 1980s and 90s when it displaced Central American youth who were forced to leave these wars, come to the U.S., to inner cities, to inequality, to violence, and to high levels of deportation that then displaced them back to Central America with no home, no community, no resources, and then created the ingredients that basically led to these very violent gangs that in fact are reproducing the type of aesthetics of violence that were introduced into Central America during those 80s and 90s by the U.S. government.
And, you know, in 2000, the political scientist and national security expert Chalmers Johnson wrote a book called Blowback, where in it, it detailed American policies and military actions across the world that breeded resentment for what actually happened in other countries, and the fact that this gives rise to terrorist groups and factions who are against U.S. interests, and the fact that the United States citizens aren't privy to this information. We're given only one side of the situation. This kind of feels like that. The U.S. goes into Central and South America for years, enacts policies, and then it creates a situation to where people are coming. This is not so much a militaristic blowback, but more of a human blowback from people actually leaving these decimated areas. Let me ask you, your family is from El Salvador. How have these political actions affected you and your family?
I mean, I wouldn't be here, basically, if it wasn't for that one. My parents are both from El Salvador, and they're from very humble means. So they definitely struggled economically. My father was, you know, working in the fields. My mother's from a small village. But when they left El Salvador, it was in the late 1970s when the war hadn't officially begun, but the repression was already happening. People fighting back in the 1980s was the result of decades of repression and violence to the point that they can't take it anymore, which is what leads to revolt, revolution, or civil wars. So my parents were definitely living at that time. They left and headed to Los Angeles, which is where I was born. So my parents didn't physically live the war during the 80s and 90s there, but the rest of our family did. And I remember as a child, family members coming or friends of family coming to our home and just giving my parents the latest news. You know, the neighbor, something really horrible happened to her. The military came looking for her. You know, I remember a unique case of a grandma and her grandchildren who were all decapitated, you know, in their home as a warning sign to her son because they thought that he was involved in quote unquote leftist activities. So these were the kind of like visual signs that they would leave. And even though I didn't see them myself, hearing about them as a child constantly, I almost materialized them in my brain as my own memories. And so something very unique, I think, about, you know, my situation, but also many of my generation, is that many of us lived in this culture of trauma, you know, and, you know, there's a very big difference between people who come looking for economic opportunities, which is definitely part of the case for many Central Americans. But it's another thing to come fleeing for your life and having experienced torture, disappearances, or death of family members and feeling silenced and not able to speak about those things because you're still in fear of your life, even if you're in another country. And I think that kind of trauma really created a culture of silence as well. Or as a consequence, you know, what are the good things that come from the region besides violence, you know, and trauma? And that's kind of like another stigma that emerges from that.
Here in the U.S., the common perception is that this is the great place to be, a place for freedom and prosperity, and people just want to be a part of it because the U.S. is the best. Tell us, what's wrong with that sort of thinking?
I mean, so much. I think we can start with just the historical amnesia. Most people don't know the history of U.S. involvement in Central America as recent as a few years ago. It eliminates that and creates this myth of just, you know, this U.S. exceptionalism as part of this own self-constructed narrative. People don't look in other countries at the U.S. necessarily and think, oh, wow, what a great country. Let me just leave everything behind and risk my life with no resources trying to get there, right? People who come here have no choice. Nobody wants to just make a life-changing decision in 1 second to leave their homes, to not say goodbye to their parents, to not say goodbye to their children, to their partners. I think we need to give credit to many people, including in Central American countries and Latin American countries, who do know actually history, who have seen the U.S. soldiers in their neighborhoods, who have seen the military disappear their neighbors, who remember that type of repression, and for whom many of their own presidents and governments are usually supporting U.S. interests and not necessarily that of the people.
This pandemic under President Trump, we're seeing the fragility of this democracy. Many of us have taken it for granted. People are being activated and mobilized now, but I think for years they kind of thought these institutions would stand on their own. As you're watching all of this unfold, does this bring up thoughts about the ways other dictatorships manage to get a hold and a grip on a country? Do you see any warning signs of that type of thing developing here?
Yes, definitely. You know, studying Latin America, there's so many cases that come up. What we see in some of these cases and what we see now, if we're looking for warning signs, is that these dictators have always had their own self-interest, accumulating their wealth, securing wealth for their family. That has been their main concern. But some of these signs, so for instance, definitely ruling with an iron fist, placing unqualified family members and friends in positions of power in order to protect themselves from opposition. Or we even see them making harsh drastic changes to laws or eliminating laws or implementing new laws to protect their own criminal acts. The manipulation of elections is very consistent in order to maintain power among these dictators. And of course, a heavy policing of the people, which then leads to mass imprisonment, justifying anybody who opposes their policies as subversive or leftist or communist or any word that somehow discredits their actions. And then once criminalizing, imprisoning them and justifying their torture and even death. When I think about some of these signs, we see all of this today. Many of these dictators have the blood of thousands on their hands. And with this current administration, I mean, we see the mass repression of protesters. We see changes to law. We'll see how the elections unfold, but we already see signs of manipulations and changing laws to ensure certain results. And with the detentions, we see mass imprisonment, torture, and definitely death.
Now, you study the way artists engage and push back under totalitarian governments. So many artists in the U.S. seem uncertain about what to do during this time. Do you have any thoughts for people about how their work can engage with the moment that we're in?
Yes, I think we can learn a lot from other resistance movements, other people, other artists who have been under similar situations. So yes, you know, I teach how artists in Latin America fight these totalitarian governments, especially from the 1960s on. Knowing some of those strategies is useful. For instance, one of the things that I've seen, and I teach about this in my classes, is that once artists are under these conditions, they are forced to find new strategies, right? And the goals that they might have had as artists, for instance, to exhibit in a mainstream gallery or to be part of a museum collection or to be accepted by the art institution, is no longer that important or urgent. It doesn't mean it goes away, but what artists throughout these situations have done is that they have found new strategies that led them to reconceptualize what art and activism really is. And what we saw, especially in Latin America, was that then artists, you know, especially let's say in Chile and Argentina and Uruguay and all of these places where dictators were repressing people, disappearing people, torturing people, the body became the most important weapon. Right. So we see an intervention of spaces. Spaces that have been militarized were now being taken back by artists as spaces of creation. The body, which is often the target of military repression and policing, was used as a weapon for artistic creation. Art changed drastically during these periods of heavy repression forever. And I think that artists today, especially those who have already been socially conscious and addressing these issues, this is nothing new to them. The thing now is the urgency, finding new strategies, how bold one wants to be, how they want to find new mediums. I think the important thing is that in the face and in the logic of death and repression that we see now, creation is still around. Radical act. Doing, creating, and countering the logic of death with life is still very important, and it may not seem that drastic. Art is usually underestimated by governments, but that's precisely what makes it so powerful to create messages as a way of communication and as a way of intervention.
She is Professor Kenzie Cornejo. She teaches contemporary art in Latin America at the University of New Mexico. Dr. Cornejo, thanks again for being on the show to give us this context. No More Normal is brought to you by Your New Mexico Government, a collaboration between KUNM, New Mexico PBS, and the Santa Fe Reporter. Funding for our coverage comes from the New Mexico Local News Fund, the Kellogg Foundation, and KUNM listeners like you. Support for public media provided by the Thornburg Foundation.
Okay, executive producer Marisa DeMarco here. Omeka is an artist, activist, and scholar from LA and Mexico who generously let us use his music for this show. The song is called Define, off an album of the same name that he released about a year ago. Thanks, Omeka. Thank you.
Un consumidor criminal que solo existe para servir. Una figura de sombra, ingrávida, prematura. Un niño que nunca crece, así que siempre inseguro. Al cruzar la línea, me volví impuro. Con mis manos limpio los restos, intento mantener la calma. Reclamo mi alma a través del trabajo, el trabajo es dolor y trabajo con él. Aprendí que el servir es ganar, retrasar el proceso, abogar para ti. El mandar es normal del pecado, la pena me dice que viene cadenas en venas en vez de las alas. Alma perdida, sirviendo a los que quedaron en vano. La noche, mía, el mundo duerme. Me preparo para el día que viene y así volver a perderme en el tiempo. Gasto ganancias, espero que veas, mis modos son los tuyos. Gasto más para sentir que soy alguien, olvidarlo de antes. Sucumbir a ti lo sé, tú trames esto lo sé. Tú quieres definirme para garantizar tu futuro, lo sé. Si defino el mío, el tuyo es incierto. Queda claro, mi lucha me deja reconocer esto. Rompí cadenas, ejemplo de poder, ajá. Definí mi historia, crucé la línea como un deja queja que me da sueño, no nunca cuenta con uno de ellos. Siempre he contado solo con mis sellos y nada gratis, aquí solo mi empeño. Ejemplo de los que empiezan en cero, dicen que yo me siento como dueño. Es lo que pasa cuando quitan las manos, zapatos, garras y sogas del cuello. Psh, yeah. No tengo miedo, oro a cadenas en cuello, que bello. Si vivo la vida no me apuro, no pienso dar por vencido el pasado, presente, futuro. Pues sé lo que tengo, no pido, lo tomo, no robo. Yo sé lo que quiero, yo me defino. Welcome.
Cabillo is an attorney who's been working to get his client, who has COVID, released from an ICE detention center. We spoke Friday, August 14th. You were in a trial yesterday representing a client who was in ICE detention who had COVID. Was your client released?
Not yet. We're working on that. He should be released in the next, hopefully today.
Okay. Now, did your client contract coronavirus while they were in detention?
We're not certain. When he arrived, he was tested and he did test positive at that time. He's been in the facility for a few months now.
Okay. So what are you hearing about the conditions inside from your client and the way the virus is spreading? You know, what really stands out to you?
So I think the biggest problem is identification of those that are positive. In other words, not everyone is being tested immediately, or if they are, the results are coming in delayed after they've already been in the general population. This facility in particular is second to only one other facility in the number of segregated individuals held in segregation that have tested positive.
Now, when you're hearing from your clients in ICE detention during this pandemic, what are their primary concerns?
Well, one of the biggest concerns is the basic question, am I going to die here? If I get sick, am I going to get the medical care that I would if I wasn't detained? Just because I'm a non-citizen doesn't mean that I don't deserve the medical care that is available for this illness. Another big concern is they're being transferred. So if one facility in El Paso, Texas, gets a number of cases that test positive, instead of counting them in that area, they'll move them to a different facility across the border into New Mexico. And so that's another concern, is the fact that they're not being accounted for appropriately in both facilities. And so it's a transfer of individuals to prevent, I think, an accurate count.
Now, is this affecting your client's mental health?
For those of us that are not in detention, we have some control over whether we expose ourselves to risk or not, and to what level. Whenever you're in detention, you have zero control over who you get to be around, where you can sequester yourself, what kind of cleaning facilities you have or are in. And so for those of us that are out and complaining about quarantining and being at home, it's quite radical in comparison to what they're going through in detention for an immigration violation.
Is this one of the more commonly misunderstood things about this process in detention that's made by the public? People don't necessarily understand exactly the situation of what's happening in like Otero County and across the country?
I think the biggest misconception with immigration cases is more the fact that these are not necessarily criminal cases. In fact, they're not. These are civil cases. Civil cases, just like a divorce in civil court, just like a lawsuit. These are individuals that are going through civil proceedings. And so to place them in more harm and not have greater use of alternatives to detention, I think it's easy to say they broke the law and we got to lock them up until we adjudicate their cases. But that's just simply not the case. It's a civil proceeding and it's a complex one. And so the lack of use of alternatives to detention, especially during this pandemic, I think is something that is of note.
Do you think, in your opinion, that these are human rights violations?
We don't detain individuals that are in divorce proceedings.
Yeah.
We don't detain individuals that are in a civil lawsuit. It's just not the case. So I think that we have to look at different things. Having individuals that are in there that are pregnant, that have no criminal history, that are not violent offenders in detention for these civil proceedings, whenever there are alternatives, I think that does rise or can rise to the level of a human rights violation.
I want to thank you very much for taking time to be with me. He's Daniel Caudillo. He is an immigration lawyer in El Paso, Texas. Thanks again, Daniel.
Absolutely.
When thinking about detention and immigration policy, it's important to understand the history of ICE and the treatment of immigrants and refugees. For that, I spoke with Jackie Stevens, professor at Northwestern University and the founding director of the Deportation Research Clinic. People in America, they've grown accustomed to the idea of ICE detention being like a kind of prison. And it seems like the U.S. has always done things this way. But this version of ICE detention is actually, it's really new in development in American history, right? So when and where did that come about? How did it come about?
Well, just to get a sense of what it was like before the punitive prison-like structures people now inhabit, it might be interesting to listen to what a report from 1915 by the Department of Labor to Congress says about how they are holding people. So I hope it's okay if I quote from this a little bit.
Please.
So the report says, "The character and condition of immigration stations at ports of entry are of prime importance. The Department of Labor aims to make these stations as much like temporary homes as possible." It should be understood by all who participate in administering these laws that they are not intended to be penalizing. And then the report continues, it is with no unfriendliness to aliens that immigrants are detained and some of them excluded, but solely for the protection of our own people and our institutions. Indifference then to the physical or mental comfort of these wards of ours from other lands should not be tolerated. So that's from 1915.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at that point, it really was conditions that would be closer to college dorms or, you know, a camp that wasn't a detention camp, but just like a campground or something like that. Mm-hmm. Than what we see today.
Mm-hmm. Now, we see that report from 105 years ago, and here we are in 2020 dealing with ICE detention centers. To me, looks like very egregious human rights violations. How did we change from that being in the law in this report to what we have now?
Right. So between 1954 and 1981, there really was no long-term detention of anybody who was in immigration proceedings. So people would apply and they would be accepted or not.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in 1981 is that there's a big arrival of people from Haiti and Cuba claiming asylum. And I think the quickest shorthand to explain what happens is racism.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get a lot of people of color who are arriving, they start to criminalize that process. And even though there's actually no regulation on the books to authorize holding people in penal conditions, they start trying to put people in jails and state prisons. And then there's some lawsuits that say, hey, you have no legal authority to do that. So then they write a new regulation that tries to authorize them to move in that direction. And that's the time frame when the private prisons start to really stake a claim in that business.
Okay. Now, explain to my listeners and myself about the privatization of ICE detention centers and how that plays into the situation that we're seeing now.
Once you get the private prison industry involved, then you have a special interest group that has a big stake mm-hmm. in increasing detention because that's how they're getting paid. And so all of a sudden you get this growth in legislation, and it continues until 2010 when you get a law that was signed by President Obama that says that ICE is mandated to have the capacity to hold no fewer than 34,000 people each night in custody under immigration laws, and it's not tied to any specific wrongdoing. It's just, you know, saying, hey, pay private prisons to have this capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is the direct outgrowth of years of lobbying.
And that's very interesting that they have this minimum taken on to these, essentially, I'm going to call them contracts rather than regulations, because that's what they seem to be designed to be. They have a minimum rather than trying to prevent the detention of people.
Yeah, minimum of 34,000.
Wow.
And actually, I mean, under Trump, I think that's gone up before the pandemic to 52,000.
Here in New Mexico, coronavirus spread through the Otero County facility early on in the pandemic. The private company that runs the place, the Management and Training Corporation, told county officials at the end of March that because there were less people being locked up, MTC was going to bail on its contract. Now, do you think profitability in contracts are playing a role in whether the U.S. releases people during this pandemic?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that is not a question. And in a lot of the contracts, there's an assumption that the firm is going to be responsible for providing health care. And so if that gets too expensive, then they have a big incentive to opt out of completing the contract.
I'm puzzled about this contract, particularly a government contract. You just wouldn't be able to walk away from it like that.
I mean, one would think.
Yeah.
I mean, the government would have to sue to have it enforced and then show damages to incentivize the firm not to do that. And so I actually am not familiar with any cases in which a contractor ended its obligations prior to what the commitment was. So I don't know what would happen in that case.
As soon as we find out more, I'd love to give you a call back so we can talk about this a little bit further. And there's been lawsuits about detainees doing labor for absurdly low wages in ICE detention, like something like $1 a day.
Mm-hmm.
On what basis were those lawsuits filed?
So the 13th Amendment exempts from the prohibition against slavery or forced labor, work that's performed is a condition of punishment. Mm. So in the prisons, CoreCivic and GEO and MTC force people to work because of the 13th Amendment exemption, but they can't do that for people who are in custody under immigration laws. There's a whole series of Supreme Court cases that say that you can't put people at hard labor unless there's a conviction for a crime. And so that's what the litigation is about, is saying, look, you're forcing people to work or you're not enforcing the labor laws.
Mm-hmm. How are these lawsuits holding up in court currently?
I think of the 7 lawsuits that have been filed around the country, all of them have survived the motions to dismiss, except for the one in New Mexico, and that's on appeal right now in the 4th Circuit. But all of the other lawsuits have been green-lighted, and there's classes that have been certified. So there's hundreds of thousands of people now who've been in ICE custody who have the prerogative to join these class action lawsuits.
Now, I'm going to talk about politicians and how they talk about immigration and immigrants. And I think I know your answer already. But tell me, how do you feel about private companies profiting from ICE detention centers and how that plays a role in how these candidates and politicians talk about immigration and immigrants?
Obviously, it's very disturbing, and it really distorts our labor markets and our political process by having this industry being able to get these super profits because of their ability to unlawfully exploit the people in their custody and then use those profits to advance a very specific agenda that every economist has shown is not in the interest of the United States, right? Like, it's actually not good for even U.S. workers to have a labor market that's artificially shut off the way that our immigration laws now do.
You know, you mentioned before about the change from 1915 to 2020, it's starting in like 1981, that, you know, a lot of this looks like it's being steeped in racism. And talk to me about that. How much of this is like racism and a xenophobia that has kind of permeated the American consciousness when we talk about immigrants?
Part of this is because, unlike criminal cases, the records of immigration cases are private. So unless you're physically in an immigration court, you can't find out what exactly is going on. In fact, it's very difficult even to locate where people are being held. So one problem is that while you have still majorities of people in the United States who favor a progressive immigration policy, you have this administrative state that is doing things kind of under the table, and it's very difficult to hold the agency accountable.
Mm-hmm.
And then a second problem is that even when Congress finds out about what's going on and has hearings, ICE really kind of hides the ball and doesn't report accurately on what it's doing, makes claims that it's changed policies it has not in fact changed, doesn't hold accountable the agents who are clearly harming people and putting people in danger. And there seems to be very, very little accountability for that agency, in part because of what they do. Like, if you abuse someone in a prison, their family's going to be around. Somebody's going to be able to point this out.
Mm-hmm.
In immigration proceedings, they basically deport the evidence. If something bad happens to you, they'll just get rid of you.
Is there anything that people can do to help?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, in non-COVID conditions, what people can do is actually show up at the immigration court. Immigration hearings are supposed to be open to the public, and they are still functioning, so they are actually having these proceedings. It's been widely reported that when there are outside observers, the immigration judges and ICE are on much better behavior than when they're doing things in secret. So that's one really concrete thing that anybody can do. More generally, obviously, it would be to vote for politicians who have policy preferences that don't support the private prison industry and don't support restrictive law enforcement against immigrants.
Do you think it's time that we consider the adaptation of a new constitutional amendment?
Yes, that's so funny that you mentioned this. I don't know if the one that you have in mind was one that was proposed first by the Wall Street Journal in 1984, which was to add 5 words to the United States Constitution. There shall be open borders.
Ah, well.
That would be the constitutional amendment I would support.
I'd be interesting to see that. That'd be an interesting debate to see happen on Capitol Hill. And finally, from just talking to you for these short few minutes, I already see that transparency is a word that I don't know if immigration officials and ICE officials necessarily use or know that is available. Talk to me about that lack of transparency and how the pandemic potentially can make the situation worse.
you know, one of the problems is that they often use both the privacy of immigration proceedings and the privacy rights that people have to their health and medical data to basically put a clamp on releasing any kind of information or telling people anything about what's going on. And so, especially in the time where there's a medical emergency, it thickens the pretext for them to refuse to release information about what's actually happening, just at the time when we, of course, need it the most.
She is Jackie Stevens, professor at Northwestern University and the founding director of the Deportation Research Clinic. Thanks a lot, Jackie.
Okay, thank you so much.
An effort to get public money out of private ICE detention in New Mexico saw a partial victory this week. A coalition of educators and immigrants' rights advocates have been urging the New Mexico Educational Retirement Board to drop investments in CoreCivic and GEO Group, corporations that own or manage three-quarters of migrant detention facilities in the U.S. and are accused of a range of civil and human rights abuses. Between the two, they also imprison hundreds of state and federal inmates in four New Mexico counties. In a retirement board meeting Friday, members pushed off a decision to divest until later this fall, but the stock market decided for them in one case. CoreCivic is being dropped from the fund's portfolio this week due to poor financial returns. KUNM's Hannah Colton has the story, starting at a protest on August 7th at the University of New Mexico, where activists rallied against the warehousing of people for profit.
Education, not deportation!
Activists have been out week after week since April in Free Them All Friday actions demanding the release of prisoners during the pandemic. This time, along with signs and banners, they set up a table so people could write the NMERB ahead of the board meeting this week.
We have a computer set up, hand sanitizer, so you can email in your comments like before 5 o'clock today, probably is when they're gonna stop taking them.
Sarah Knope is a PhD student at UNM and a prison abolitionist. She spoke about people incarcerated in Cibola County, where CoreCivic runs a compound that's a federal prison, a county jail, and ICE detention all in one.
We need to shut down Cibola Correctional Center now. None of the asylum seekers who are there belong there. They've committed no crime. We don't need a prison next to Navajo Nation on stolen land where it's infecting people on Navajo Nation.
There's been a huge COVID outbreak among federal detainees in Cibola County in the past few weeks, 314 cases as of this Friday. NM In Depth reported that spurred a protest about conditions there during the pandemic by people being detained on August 5th. There are 44 cases among federal prisoners at the CoreCivic site in Torrance County and 900 more in Otero County, where a different private prison company holds the keys. The pandemic has added urgency to a divestment fight that the Santa Fe Dreamers Project and others started over a year ago, joined by teachers' unions, university faculty, the Española and Santa Fe school boards, financial advisors, and artists. The coalition collected 1,400 signatures of educators who don't want their pension funds going to private prisons and migrant detention. Dare Obenshain, a co-founder of Teachers Against Child Detention, is a music teacher in Albuquerque. She says the retirement board has been resistant to their members' demands.
And they claim that it's fiscal responsibility that forces them to continue investing in private prisons. But before the COVID pandemic, those stocks in GEO Group and CoreCivic were losing a lot of money. So it's not only morally reprehensible, but fiscally irresponsible.
GEO Group and CoreCivic account for less than $1 million of the $13 billion fund. Obenshain led a sing-along to a Linda Ronstadt tune for the 20 people gathered. But the eight-member board on Friday heard from their legal and financial advisors that it wasn't going to be so easy. For one thing, the Trump administration's Department of Labor has proposed rules that discourage investment decisions based on social and environmental factors. Attorney David Powell of the Groom Group explained.
You may conclude that a particular aspect of some company may be a social bad, but you cannot make the decision to invest in it or to sell it unless you can make the decision that it is in the financial interest of the fund to do so, and you are not permitted to sacrifice return for those decisions.
The real sticking point, though, was the way decision-making is set up. Chief Investment Officer Bob Jackshaw said paying someone to manage individual stocks day-to-day wasn't cost-effective in the past. Instead, he said board policy is to invest in index funds, including everything in the S&P 400.
The policy does not give the staff discretion to vary from that. We simply follow what Standard & Poor's is doing with the index.
In stock market speak, CoreCivic has been underperforming. So Jackshaw said S&P is dropping it from the 400 index. That means the NMERB is out of the ICE detention business in New Mexico, effective Monday. A win for the coalition. But Geo Group is still on the list. And full disclosure, as an employee of the University of New Mexico, money is extracted from my own paychecks and put into that fund every month. The board did not allow time for oral public comments, but that didn't stop people from chiming in at several points.
I would just like to take this opportunity to highlight the majority white-led ERB board voting on...
Madam Chair, this is Suzanne Rubio, General Counsel.
Slavery is not a retirement plan. I yield my time.
In the end, State Treasurer Tim Eichenberg proposed that staff write up a policy change that would make a path to divestment.
I just want the opportunity every once in a while to say, whether it's climate change or whatever that comes before us through an S&P investment, that we get to say, wait a minute, our policy allows us to say we don't want to do that anymore.
The motion passed unanimously. The board could review those policy recommendations as soon as their next meeting in mid-October. All the bureaucratic back and forth was frustrating to coalition members.
Disappointment, major disappointment.
That's Suhan Ho, a UNM professor, artist, and activist. She says all the talk of policy hurdles didn't match up with what NMERB staff and board members had said before.
There were some members of the board who really supported putting this to a vote, like yes or no, what can we divest right now? Based on all of our information, we understood that it was possible.
Ho works with the Fronteristas Artists Collective. You might have seen photos on social media recently of their work at their roundhouse in Santa Fe. Giant white banners with "Free Them All" written in bright pink by a statue of kids playing tug of war in front of the Capitol.
There was a cage installed over the boys in the statue, so it looks like the girls in the statue are pulling them out of the cage.
Ho and other activists are frustrated with slow action by the board when they say there's a human rights crisis at the border.
We do think that CoreCivic and Geo Group are violating the Constitution. We also believe the administration is violating the Constitution by what they're doing with warehousing migrants on the border, separating families, you know, housing youth in shelters and not allowing them to go to their sponsors. You know, the fundamental problem is that these companies have a profit incentive to warehouse humans. So they're actually always going to want more bodies.
The nationwide movement to divest, though, is growing. Since the Families Belong Together campaign started organizing after Trump's family separation policy hit the news in 2018, most major banks have cut ties with Geo Group and CoreCivic. Ho says she got an indication of the movement's impact when a representative from Geo Group wrote the NMRB directly this month in response to an op-ed by a coalition member that was published in the Santa Fe New Mexican.
So the fact that Geo Group feels the need to respond to this very small kind of pension fund investment, you know, relatively, I think that means the divestment movement is gaining a lot of traction nationally and globally.
She hopes if New Mexico can go through with divestment this fall, that will encourage other pension boards in other states to do the same. For KUNM, I'm Hannah Colton.
I spoke with Bonnie Arzuaga, co-founder of Doctors for Camp Closure, a nonpartisan organization of over 2,000 physicians and healthcare professionals from all specialties who oppose the inhumane detention of migrants and refugees attempting to enter the United States of America. Let me ask you, so ICE is reporting that more than 4,000 people are infected. Early on, we kept hearing about how if there were outbreaks, nearby hospitals would be overwhelmed. Is that something that you all are keeping your eye on?
Of course, yeah. We've actually been keeping our eye on this since March when the pandemic first cropped up in the Northeast. These detention centers are within communities, and so as the community resources get overwhelmed, if you have an outbreak within a detention facility itself, that's going to even further stress the system. And so that was a big worry of ours since the beginning. And we are seeing in some areas of the country, as they are having some increased cases of COVID within these detention facilities, that those people from the detention centers are needing medical care. So that is definitely increasing the strain on the healthcare systems within those communities, for sure.
What steps are the doctors for camp closure taking right now?
We've been really focusing for the past few months on individual cases that come across our desks. So we'll have attorneys or advocates from different parts of the country who are working with people in detention contact us, and they're asking really for letters of medical support. Most of these cases that we get are people who have underlying medical conditions already, such as asthma, diabetes, high blood pressure, things like that, and they are trying to get those people released. And so we've been writing letters and writing affidavits and really trying to support the advocates and the attorneys in that way. And we've actually been able to get, you know, more than a few people released. It's slow going because it's one case at a time, literally. I'm working on a case right now of a man who we've been trying to get released because he has some underlying health conditions. And unfortunately, I just found out yesterday that he's now been diagnosed with COVID. And not only that, but he was moved 2 days before his diagnosis. He was moved to a different facility. So this it sort of underscores that, you know, these things are still continuing to happen even now, 4 or 5 months into this pandemic.
Now, why is your organization advocating that these places be closed? And what do you think should be in place instead?
We advocate for community placement programs. Prior to this current administration, there were actually very successful community placement programs. And so what that means is that a person who is coming across the border seeking asylum or a refugee, while their application was being processed, they'd be placed in communities. Many people who are coming across already have contacts and family members here in the United States. They would be placed in those communities. They would have sort of a caseworker. They'd have some social supports. And programs like that were very successful. If you look at some of the literature examining those programs, 95 to 99% of the people who were placed in their communities would show up to their court dates, and they would go through the legal process of claiming asylum or refugee status. And so those programs actually, if you looked at the outcomes, not only were the people compliant with the program, but they also had good outcomes as far as their mental health, their psychological health, their physical health, and they became active and productive members of those communities. Once this current presidential administration came into power, they sort of gutted all of those communities. So any money that was allocated for those programs was not used, and instead they started filling up detention centers. These community programs work, and not only do they work, but they're also cheaper. If you do like a cost analysis, it only costs a few dollars a day for these community programs to run, whereas it costs us $600 or $700 a day to keep people in detention. You can't even really make a cost argument on top of everything else.
She is Dr. Bani Azuraga. She is co-founder of Doctors for Camp Closure. Thank you again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Santa Fe Dreamers Project provides free legal services to immigrants to promote economic empowerment, community development, family unity, and liberation from detention. I spoke with Allegra Love, attorney and director for the project. Allegra, thanks for being with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you've worked with people in ICE detentions a long time. How has the pandemic changed your job?
So the urgency, it was already urgent, and now this has become deadlier, more dangerous, more dehumanizing. If you had told me in January this system could get deadlier and more dehumanizing, I would have been like, dude, there's no way. And it did. The pandemic made that happen.
Speak to me about the pandemic that most of us are paying attention to and really trying to avoid contracting. But tell me of the difference in what has changed for the people and what they're experiencing inside.
Well, so think about the way the question you just said and how you said it. Like the things that we're doing to avoid contracting it. We are in charge of our bodies, right? So we can stay 6 feet from people. We can put a face mask on. We can scrub our hands. We cannot leave our house. We can control our exposure and our anxiety. The ones of us who are lucky, you know?
Yeah.
And manage our fear of what's unknown by having control of our bodies and the spaces that are our own. And for someone in detention, they don't have that. They don't have access to soap in a lot of cases. They can't put space between them and guards, other detainees. You know, I talked to a woman with her child, who was detained with her child in detention the other day, and she hadn't been given a fresh mask since April. She's been wearing the same paper mask on her face and her child's face since April. And she says she regularly has contact with unmasked guards in the detention center. So I was like, how many times? And she was like, I don't even know, 100? So for people who are incarcerated right now or in detention, they don't have any control over their space. They don't have any control of their sanitation. They don't have the tools that they need to have like the basic human control of their own body and keeping their body protected and safe during a pandemic. They know it's happening. They're terrified. Our clients are calling us being like, get me out of here. I feel like I'm in a burning building and no one will let me out. And it's so frightening.
Yeah. Are you or other service providers able to get clients any extra supplies?
No. I have groups contact me from all over the country being like, we'd love to be able to get masks to your clients who are inside. We have hand sanitizer, soap. All of that comes through private subcontractors. Like, this is a big business.
Now, have you heard from any of clients about being abused physically?
We've heard from folks about being tear gassed in Torrance County. We're hearing it from various facilities all over the country. But, you know, people are getting rowdy. People are getting restless. And they're controlling people inside by tear gassing. It makes me choke up. You know, they're like clamoring for masks or protective equipment, and then they get tear gassed.
Wow. Are there any moves to take up these human rights violations as one big case in court?
My colleagues all over the country, we've been suing in every jurisdiction for the release of people due to COVID-19. There's been a couple victories, but it hasn't largely been effective. And like here in New Mexico, we've had two enormous outbreaks in our private facilities in Otero County and Cibola County. Enormous outbreaks.
You know, the public doesn't necessarily understand the nuances and the details about this situation because of political rhetoric and all the campaigning, which is going extra hard now. What type of filter do you suggest people put on to their minds and ears when they hear this political rhetoric coming out about ICE detention centers and immigration?
What they want you to believe is that these folks who are being detained, immigrants, have done something so bad that any way we want to treat their body, and even if we want to profit off of their body, like corporations want to profit off of them in these private detention centers, that they deserve it. And what's really wild is for a huge, 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 huge percentage of the people, they've never actually done anything illegal at all. They've come to our border seeking asylum in the United States, which is like a fundamentally legal action. There's no way you can do it illegally. And people get really, 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 they use this idea of the rule of law as cover to express some really, really racist and xenophobic and classist ideas about other people. They say, like, I'm not a racist. I love foreigners. I love immigrants. I just can't deal with people who do things illegally. I've had clients who have had horrifically violent things happen to them in detention, things that I wouldn't want to say on live radio. And there are still people who say, like, look, if she didn't want that to happen to her, she shouldn't have tried to come to this country. As if any punishment possible is appropriate once someone has breached that, like, moral code. And we need to reorient our thinking around that. We've already hurt way too many people.
Thank you very much for being on with me and letting us know about what is happening. Please come on to the show again.
Anytime. This is great.
Wonderful. She's Allegra Love. She is with the Santa Fe Dreamers Project. Thanks again, Allegra. From people packed in detention centers to kids packed in classrooms. Next week, Nomono explores why it might not be an A-plus decision to reopen schools so quickly. That's next week on No More Normal. check us out. Thanks to Benjamin Eaglin, Omeka, reporter Yasmeed Khan, and KUNM News Director Hannah Colton for contributing to the show today. Thanks to Ty Bannerman, Taylor Velasquez, Kaveh Movahed, and Nash Jones, who chipped in on the editing. You guys are the bomb. Thanks to Frontaristas and Anonymous for the artwork on this post. Music for the show provided by Jazzstone, the producer, Cheo, Dom Life, and Olad Records. Khaki, Pope Yes Yes Y'all, and Bigawatt composed some of the show's themes. We always, always have more content that will fit into the broadcast hour. Find a really great conversation with Allegra Love from the Santa Fe Dreamers Project on the online version of this show or anywhere you get your podcasts. No More Normal is executive produced by Marisa DeMarco, produced and hosted by yours truly. I am Khalil A. Colonna. For everyone here at No More Normal, thanks for listening.